Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and commentator Rahul Mahajan, who examines the difficulties ahead for the U.S. and its Iraqi partners as the June 30th date of transfer approaches. Beth Parker, the San Francisco attorney who helped overturn the Republican-backed Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, who assesses the judge's ruling and public support for abortion rights. And Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas, who takes a critical look at how the media has portrayed the presidency of Ronald Reagan following his death at age 93. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new wave of violence gripped the Democratic Republic of the Congo during the first week of June. A rebel commander, Brigadier General Laurent Nkunda, took over the city of Bukavu near the Rwanda border. In response, protesters stormed United Nations compounds all across the Congo in anger over the inability of UN peacekeepers to stop rebel advances. In the capital city of Kinshasa, UN troops killed two protesters as over 1,000 people stormed a UN base. Young women in a massive refugee camp in Bunia in northeast Congo continue to be sexually abused by soldiers. According to Britain's independent newspaper, the troops committing the sexual violence are UN peacekeepers stationed next to the camp for displaced persons, where over 15,000 people live. Inside the camp, Fela, a 13-year-old mother, says she sleeps with UN soldiers in exchange for food and security for her infant son. Yet the victimized teenage girls are reluctant to provide evidence of sexual abuse to investigators. They are fearful of all soldiers, both local and foreign, and know the long history of rape in the decade-long civil war in the Congo that has displaced over 3 million people. As Patrick Barbier of Doctors Without Borders noted, it is clear that the necessary steps to protect the displaced people from violence and sexual exploitation have not been followed in the camp in Bunia. The need to protect these girls is urgent. The Financial Times reports that the Indonesian government has ordered Sidney Jones, regional director of the International Crisis Group, to leave the Asian country. Many informed observers say this is a move by Indonesia's intelligence agency to flex its muscle in the wake of criticism by human rights groups and international monitors like ICG. In recent months, Jones' report on the Indonesian military's repression in the province of Aceh, where the government imposed a year of martial law, has angered the country's security services. In a closed-door committee meeting in Parliament, the head of Indonesia's intelligence agency said that the ICG and 19 other non-governmental organizations were on a government watch list for posing a threat to national security. Jones, who used to work for Human Rights Watch, was requested to leave Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim country, because she violated her work permit by traveling outside the capital city of Jakarta. Jones is viewed by many as the West's leading authority on Islamic militancy in Southeast Asia. She has written an in-depth study on Jamaah Islamiyah, the group blamed for the bloody terrorist bombing in Bali and the bombing of the Marriott Hotel in Jakarta. International green development groups are blasting the World Bank for pledging limited funding increases to renewable energy projects. Over the next 6 years, the bank will boost renewable projects by $200 million. The promise was made in the run-up to the International Conference on Renewable Energies in Bonn, Germany. Greens say the increased funding only equals the cost of a single fossil fuel plant. According to the website oneworld.net, this announcement is being watched closely because it is the first action taken since the release of the World Bank-sponsored study of extractive industries. The 3-year study concluded that the World Bank should phase out funding for fossil fuel projects by 2008. The bank's managing director, Peter Woik, says the study's recommendations are much too ambitious, and he criticized green groups for pushing clean technology too quickly on the developing world while ignoring the plight of poor people. Jeanette Bruhl of Friends of the Earth International called the small funding increase for clean energy absurd, stating, "At this rate, it will take the bank nearly 20 years before its renewable funding reaches the current level for fossil fuels." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
After more than a year of deadly failures in Iraq, the Bush administration is working hard to gain international legitimacy as it prepares for a symbolic handover of sovereignty to a new interim hand-picked Iraqi government on June 30th. On June 9th, the United Nations Security Council unanimously approved a resolution jointly sponsored by the U.S. and Britain, which endorses the continuing presence of an American-led military force in the country after the transfer of power. In what was described as another success by the Bush administration, U.S. officials and Iraq's newly appointed Prime Minister Iyad Alawi announced in early June that they had brokered an agreement that will disband 9 of the nation's largest militia groups. But 2 of the groups most closely identified with the ongoing violence in Iraq were excluded from the accord: the militant Shiite Mahdi army loyal to Sheikh Muqtada al-Sadr and the Fallujah Brigade, made up of ex-Republican Guard troops and insurgents. But despite successes on the diplomatic front, Iraqi insurgents continue to attack U.S. soldiers and their allies across Iraq. As of June 7th, more than 825 U.S. soldiers have been killed, with another 18,000 injured and evacuated. Thus far, an estimated 10,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed since the U.S. invasion in March 2003. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Rahul Mahajan, author of the book Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Mahajan, who has visited Iraq twice since January, examines the difficulties ahead for the U.S. and its Iraqi partners as the June 30th date of transfer approaches.
In talking with people in Iraq, which I did quite a bit of when I was there on my 2 trips, the most common opinion was that the transfer of sovereignty had more to do with the American elections than with any elections in Iraq. But I think there are 2 views in the U.S. government, in the Bush administration, about what this so-called transfer of sovereignty should be materially on the ground. And they're conditioned by 2 things. One is a recognition by many, if not everyone, that the assault on Fallujah was a disaster in political and military terms. In military terms, it ranks as one of the few military defeats the United States has suffered since the Vietnam War, and simultaneously that of course, the revelations over Abu Ghraib have seriously undercut U.S. credibility. And on the other hand, the fact that when the United States does go back to the United Nations, it, understandably enough, is not going to be allowed to just ramrod anything through because of the way that it has treated the United Nations in the past year and a half or so. So on the one hand, there was this view of it's going to be entirely cosmetic. We're going to go about doing things the way we always did, which is to say, with a very direct and heavy hand of U.S. intervention, where the government has basically an American face, where military operations have an American face, much as was being done in April. And the other idea was, and this is more associated with the CIA and the State Department, which have been gaining the upper hand lately, is that what we need to do is, while preserving the goals of the U.S. intervention, which is to say, a permanent U.S. military presence in Iraq, severe leverage over control over Iraqi oil, and military leverage over the other countries in the region, we want to do that in a more efficient way by passing to a typical military client-state relationship in which the government has an Iraqi face. And it's that second aspect, I think, that is winning out. And the so-called transfer of sovereignty, if it means anything in Iraq, it means the attempted creation of a stable puppet Iraqi client-state government.
Rahul, tell us a little bit about the selection process for Iraq's new prime minister, Alawi, the U.S. role in that process, and his credibility among Iraqis on the street.
Well, it's very interesting because as a result of severe political problems, the United States brought in Lakhdar Brahimi, the U.N. special envoy, to try to broker a deal. And then, of course, in April, that became severely intensified with all of the scandals that broke out. And I should note that Fallujah had a much larger impact on Iraqi public consciousness than it has on American public consciousness. And Brahimi's role was to save the occupation for the United States, save the possibility of creating some kind of client state. But the United States was so unwilling to allow any kind of freedom of action for anyone it doesn't control completely, that they basically kept him from doing his job. They sidelined him and instead said, we're going to go with the most narrowly controlled puppet we can find. Iyad Alawi is sort of, he's like Ahmad Chalabi light, but he doesn't have the 2 big drawbacks that Chalabi did. They're both very closely tied to the U.S. government and Alawi also to the British government, in particular to CIA and to MI6, so they're perfect puppet figures. But on the other hand, he doesn't have Chalabi's bad name recognition. In Iraq, Chalabi is the most hated man after Bush and Sharon. And secondly, he doesn't have this distressing tendency Chalabi has shown towards expressing independent thoughts and even criticizing the United States. So he is the perfect puppet. No popular base of his own, but an ability, because he has no popular base, partly to deal with and help keep in line the various groups on the governing council that do have a popular base, and at the same time, he'll be totally beholden to U.S. dictates.
What are your concerns when you look at the transfer of power, quote-unquote, to this new interim government, as well as election year politics in the United States and how that might impact how the U.S. military interacts with the insurgents, Muqtada al-Sadr and others who are arrayed against the U.S. there?
There's going to be a great deal of violence this summer before and after the transfer of sovereignty. And as people come to see that the transfer is not going to make any difference in their day-to-day lives, and in fact, it doesn't even seem like it's going to make any difference in what faces they see on TV, because the interim government is almost just a reshuffle of the governing council. Things are going to get worse. In terms of just the level of frustration and the level of attacks. It's likely the Bush administration is going to try to deal with it by pulling U.S. troops away from contact with Iraqis, because it is certainly true, as long as they stay on their bases and their fortified hard targets, it is very difficult for Iraqi forces to attack them meaningfully. They can lob mortars over into the bases, but they can't do any serious damage. And I would expect that to happen closer to the election, as the administration wants to minimize the stream of casualties.
That was Rahul Mahajan, author of the book Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, published by Seven Stories Press. Read Mahajan's commentaries online at www.empirenotes.org. On June 1st, federal judge Phyllis Hamilton struck down the so-called Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act as unconstitutional on three grounds. The federal law, passed by the Republican-controlled Congress and signed into law by President Bush, was challenged in court by the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. But while the judge's landmark ruling protects doctors who provide abortions at all Planned Parenthood clinics throughout the country, she declined to issue a more comprehensive injunction protecting all abortion providers out of deference to two other challenges to the law currently underway in Nebraska and New York. The Bush administration has vowed to appeal any and all adverse rulings, which could involve three separate circuit courts. If there's a split in the rulings of the circuit courts, the case will go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Beth Parker, the San Francisco attorney who won the case on behalf of Planned Parenthood. She summarizes the judge's ruling and examines current public support for abortion rights and what a possible second term for George W. Bush could mean for women seeking abortions.
The three grounds are: the first was it was unconstitutional because it imposes an undue burden on a woman's right to choose to have an abortion. Under the existing law, women can have pre-viability abortions, and Congress cannot impose restrictions on that. Pre-viability is where the fetus cannot survive outside the mother. So she found that it was an undue burden on a woman's ability to choose to have a second trimester abortion, basically abortions from approximately 12 to 15 weeks to 23 weeks in pregnancy. The second reason she found it unconstitutional was that it was so vague that doctors performing procedures couldn't tell what type of procedures were banned by the act, and they were exposed to up to 2 years in prison if they violated the ban. The third reason she found it unconstitutional was that it failed to include a health exception, and the Supreme Court, in a case that came down several years ago, Stenberg versus Carhart, has said that you need to have a health exception in any ban on abortion procedures if there are some circumstances for some women where it was necessary. The act did include a very limited exception if the procedure was necessary to save the life of the mother, but it did not include any exception where the procedure was necessary for the health of the mother. And at trial, we presented extensive evidence. There are many circumstances where women have health conditions that are exacerbated by pregnancy, such as asthma, diabetes, and health conditions. And under those circumstances, often an abortion will alleviate the health conditions, and therefore these procedures are the safest under those circumstances.
The judge was very critical, wasn't she, of some of the wording in the law, including its title, the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, which has always struck me as a very politicized expression.
She said that it was not a medically recognized term. I don't believe she said this, but in fact it was chosen by the anti-choice movement as a way to really do a PR campaign against second trimester abortions, because it's not a medically recognized term.
Considering all the chipping away at abortion rights over the past several years, were you surprised by this victory, and how important was it?
It's definitely a sweeping and a landmark victory. I wasn't surprised by the result, because the medical evidence that we presented at trial was really overwhelming, that the ban is so broad that it affects all second trimester abortions, or almost all second trimester abortions, that procedures, even the very narrow procedures that the government claimed it affected, was necessary in many instances to protect a woman's health and because of lethal fetal anomalies. And the law is also very well established that you need to have a health exception in certain circumstances. That came out of the U.S. Supreme Court several years ago, and Congress was very well aware of the law when it passed that ban, and it chose to do so nonetheless.
What procedure is actually used for a second trimester abortion?
Medical procedure is very much a combination of skill and talent, and it also depends very much on the individual circumstances that are presented by a woman's anatomy and where she is in the pregnancy. So there are various procedures that different doctors use, and most doctors attempt to perform abortions in a manner that is most safe for the woman. And their preference is to extract the fetus as intact as possible, because it reduces harm and trauma to the woman. One of the things that Judge Hamilton pointed out was during the congressional hearings that there was no medical testimony from physicians who perform second trimester procedures, that the testimony was very one-sided, as opposed to the testimony that she heard at trial, where doctors who performed second trimester procedures testified at length about the procedures they used and the reasons why they perform abortions during the second trimester.
What is the state of support for abortion rights currently?
There was a poll reported in our paper about the views of Californians about abortion, and approximately 60-70% felt that the abortion laws should either remain where they are or should be broadened. And only 22% of the population felt that there should be further restrictions on access to abortion.
Now, if President Bush continues in power after the November election, it's all but certain that he'll appoint at least one anti-abortion Supreme Court judge. If that were to happen, all these laws regarding the legality of certain types of abortion would be out the window, right?
That's right. If one of the justices who's been in the majority of these cases steps down, I think we can all anticipate a major battle over the nomination of someone to replace him or her, because abortion clearly hangs in the balance.
That was attorney Beth Parker, who won the case challenging the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. Call the Planned Parenthood Federation of America at area code 415-441-7858 or visit their website at www.plannedparenthood.org. After a long battle with Alzheimer's disease, Ronald Reagan, the 40th President of the United States, died at his home in California on June 5th. Since his death, the U.S. media has focused much attention on the career of the 93-year-old president and one-time movie actor. In often reverential tones, Mr. Reagan has been characterized as one of the nation's most popular and successful presidents, with little attention paid to his administration's scandals and controversial domestic and foreign policies. While President Reagan will surely go down in history as an adept politician who was successful in shifting the national debate toward his right-wing agenda, the consequences of his policies deserve close scrutiny. During his 1980 election campaign against Jimmy Carter, Reagan's advisors have been accused of making a deal with the Iranian government to delay the release of American hostages it was holding. In the infamous Iran-Contra affair, Mr. Reagan traded arms to Iran in exchange for U.S. hostages held in Lebanon, then diverted funds to his illegal Contra war against Nicaragua. The president, who survived a 1981 assassination attempt, supported Central American death squads in the apartheid regime in South Africa, with which he worked to prosecute a bloody war against Angola. While in office, Mr. Reagan also sold arms to Iraq's Saddam Hussein and armed Islamic fundamentalists fighting the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. In domestic policy, Mr. Reagan's tax cuts for the wealthy, increased military spending, and gutting of programs benefiting the underprivileged resulted in a widening gap between rich and poor and record deficits. He will be remembered by many for busting the air traffic controllers union, ignoring the AIDS epidemic, and classifying ketchup as a vegetable. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Jensen, author and professor of journalism at the University of Texas, who takes a critical look at how the U.S. media has portrayed Ronald Reagan and explains why he feels it is important for Americans to have an objective understanding of both the accomplishments and failures of his administration.
When anyone dies, one tries to find a way to write and speak about the person with some humanity. But in this case, Reagan was referred to as the Teflon president in office. That is, nothing bad ever stuck to him, and he's certainly the Teflon presidency now that he has died. I mean, the reason this is so important now is the processes set in motion, the policies that the Reagan administration pursued, are having dramatic effects today. I mean, let's just take the two main foreign policy issues of the last 2 years, Afghanistan and Iraq. Well, of course, it was during the Reagan administration that CIA support, U.S. support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan was intensified as a way to cause trouble for the Russians, creating the seeds that essentially became al-Qaeda. That's a Reagan policy that helped create that. And, of course, in Iraq, we know that Reagan coddled Saddam Hussein. We know that as a special envoy for Reagan, Donald Rumsfeld, now the Secretary of Defense, actually went to Baghdad twice to essentially smooth things over with Saddam Hussein. We know that when the Iraqis gassed the Kurds in Halabja, in 1988, it was the Reagan administration that kept the world from instituting various kinds of sanctions and condemnations. So, you know, here we're seeing the fruits of Reagan's really quite fanatical foreign policy. The same on the domestic front. You know, Reagan pioneered the idea of driving up deficits, partly through outrageous and unnecessary defense spending, to try to hamstring the government in the future to cut social spending. David Stockman, his budget director, actually confessed to this during the Reagan administration. Well, that just happens to be the exact policy the Bush administration is following now, drive up deficits to try to further reduce, you know, minimal remnants there are of the New Deal. That's all Reagan policy. And in fact, if Reagan had not laid the groundwork for that, the Bush administration wouldn't be able to do some of what it's doing today.
When we're a few weeks down the road from Ronald Reagan's burial, how much will this matter? How much of what we're seeing and reading in the newspapers about the mythology of Ronald Reagan as our best and most beloved president, how much will that stick and what problems could it cause?
Well, I think a lot of it will stick in part because there's not a lot of other places people can go to get a critical history in the mainstream. And it will matter because the lionizing of Ronald Reagan reinforces this notion that he pursued policies that were in fact sane and reasonable. Probably the biggest lie of the Reagan presidency was, you know, at the end of his reign, he pointed out that he hoped he had been an optimistic president who had played to people's sort of best instincts instead of playing to their fears, when in fact he did just the opposite. The Reagan legacy on both domestic and foreign affairs is really, I think, indefensible. It is, in fact, a time when the United States further intensified its own terrorist campaign against the world. We should remember a time in which the United States was condemned by the World Court in 1986 for its unlawful aggression against Nicaragua. It was a time in which the United States really, you know, sort of broke from the world in new ways to become even more of a rogue state. Now, if that's our best president, I think that seriously distorts people's understanding of history. And if you distort people's understanding of history, of course, you make it hard to make clear and cogent arguments about policy in the present. So I think it will have a particularly dramatic effect, given that the Bush administration in so many ways is similar to the Reagan administration, and it will bolster Bush policies that should be subject to much more critical scrutiny.
Well, as you just indicated, this kind of long obituary, very favorable obituary about Ronald Reagan, how much will that affect the 2004 presidential race? How much do you think the Bush administration, the Bush campaign, will use the legacy of Ronald Reagan to boost his own apparent shortcomings?
Well, I think one can expect a lot of references. It's, of course, several months till the election, so it's hard to make any predictions, but I would be surprised if the Bush administration didn't invoke the memory of Ronald Reagan and the legacy directly connecting the Bush presidency to Reagan. Now, as I pointed out, they should be connected, but not in a positive way. They should be connected in the sense that we can see the continuation of really negative, dangerous, and in fact could well be almost sort of suicidal policies in the sense of taking the world down a dramatically more dangerous path than we had been on before. The Reagan people were very good at spinning history in a right-wing way, and I think the problems with that, the inaccuracies, the inadequacies of the analysis are pretty clear, and there's a period of mourning, I suppose, but I intend to be very blunt about my assessment of the Reagan administration and take that project forward, understanding that the mainstream is not likely to follow.
That was Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas and author of Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Read his articles online at www.nowarcollective.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.